I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. Remember the War on Poverty and the Great Society programs of the 1960s? Well, many of those programs made a huge difference in addressing real poverty in America. By 1973, we had the historic low of only 11% of Americans living in poverty. That was the watermark. The ranks of the poor have grown since then, and although they reached near historic lows again during the Clinton administration. But after that, poverty rose drastically, even during a booming economy. 6 million Americans fell into poverty between 2000 and 2007. After the economic crash, another 9 million people fell into poverty between 2007 and 2010. So why aren't we shocked? Why haven't we mobilized against this threat to the very foundation of our democracy? The American economy did not stagnate over the past 40 years. It grew, but the profit of that growth overwhelmingly went to the very rich. Whether we're willing to face it or not, we have become a low-wage nation. Our next guest writes, as long as middle-income voters think that they have more in common with the people at the top than the people at the bottom, we are cooked. The hole we're getting into is deeper and deeper and deeper. So to discuss this and how we turn the tide, we are joined by Peter Edelman, the author of So Rich, So Poor, Why It's So Hard to End Poverty in America. He's a professor at Georgetown University Law Center, and he worked as a top advisor to Senator Robert Kennedy from 1964 to 1968. He also worked in the Clinton administration and resigned when Clinton signed the 1996 welfare reform legislation. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Great to have you here and to talk about this very important subject. And I'll give out the number for our listeners to join us in this conversation in just a short while. But before we do that, I want to lay out the history that you paint for us in your book. You write about how the war on poverty really did help lift people's economic opportunity and outcomes in life. But then the backlash and subsequent cutbacks in the safety net, and that coupled with the fact that low-skilled jobs left the country and were replaced with low-wage service jobs, left many people, working people, in poverty. So can you first briefly explain what you saw work with the War on Poverty and Great Society programs? What was it that was working?
There are a number of pieces in the 1960s. We might actually start, rather than with the New Frontier and the Great Society, with the fact that we had a booming economy. That was very important. We also need to credit the Civil Rights Movement, because not only did it create a politics of support for taking action on poverty, the simple point that somebody wakes up and says, gee, I have a right to go to the lunch counter and buy a meal, but oh, I don't have the money in my pocket.
Well, and that was a big part of Martin Luther King Jr.'s platform at the end of his life as well, was economic.
Absolutely. The Poor People's Campaign, my wife was very involved in that, was his insight on exactly that point, economic justice. The March on Washington in 1963 was about jobs as well as about ending segregation. But, you know, you look a little bit further, and there's some indirect things. For one thing, the outlawing of employment discrimination. The African-American middle class really built within the 1960s. Some of that was getting jobs, which is maybe partly the result of the legal ban on discrimination, getting jobs in manufacturing plants and the auto and the steel and so on. And a lot of that around the entire country was getting municipal jobs, government jobs, building a black middle class in that way. And so black poverty went from 55% at the beginning of the 60s down to the low 30s. That's a really big change. But the actual programs of the Great Society, the War on Poverty, were very important. They were more important in an opportunity way, from Head Start on up through the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, Job Corps, things that even the playing field of opportunity to a great extent. the public policy of the time actually was not directly job creating, except for, and this is a big exception, the hot economy. So all those things came together in the 1960s, and that's why poverty went down ultimately in 1973 to 11.1%.
And so you say that the hot economy, the jobs, this booming post-war economy that people could get jobs that would lift them out of poverty, then couldn't you argue that it was that market force that really pulled people out of poverty more than any of these programs?
Partly, but it wouldn't have been shared, especially across racial lines, if we didn't have the Civil Rights Movement and the historic Civil Rights Act of 1964. You always have two questions. You have the question of whether the economy is growing. You have the question of who's getting the benefit of that. That's what the story is from the early 70s till the present time. There's plenty, well, not plenty, but there's been good growth. Economy is more than doubled in size, and it's not being shared. In the 1960s, it was much more shared with people who hadn't been sharing in it.
Well, so poverty was a really big deal. It was a part of a national conversation. It was a moral outrage, or seen that way in a lot of places. So what was the political shift that occurred to move that conversation towards sort of this pathology of poverty?
Well, I think there's a symbiosis between what happens to the economy and the political shift. But the political side of it is that people who had benefited, this is somewhat paradoxical or short-sighted, people who had benefited from being members of unions and being voting reliably Democrat, especially across what's now the Rust Belt, said, oh, gee, I'm doing pretty well. I don't need that anymore. And so, and the corporate community through the Nixon period figured out that they needed to be much more robust in their efforts in Washington than they ever had been, and began to get very organized and to push back against unions in every way that they could, throw sand in the gears about increasing the minimum wage and the rest of that. So you had all of those forces operating politically, and you had this change of attitudes. You know, the Reagan Democrats ultimately in 1960, the heartbeat of that being the Macomb, Michigan, which we heard about over and over again at that time. But at the same time, in a way that was really a kind of a bad interaction, we had the good manufacturing jobs disappearing, going abroad, so the globalization was beginning to eat at us, and changes in technology were beginning to eat at us. And we turned in rather quickly into the low-wage nation that we are now. And it was a little bit like the frog being boiled, you know, being in there in the water and not knowing exactly when the fatal stroke hit.
Were there structural policies that could have been enacted? Were there things that the U.S. could have done to react to that loss of manufacturing jobs in a different way? Did other nations react differently, or is this just a global phenomenon?
Well, the answer to that is yes and no. That is to say, you're not going to stop globalization. We did some things later on that were probably mistakes in terms of not negotiating tough enough on the trade deals and insisting that trading partners pay have Fair Labor Standards Act standards and environmental standards. But going back into the 1970s, there was a change really in the Democratic Party. And it became more suburbanized, really not the same kind of Hubert Humphrey or Franklin D. Roosevelt kind of working class labor minority partnership that sort of frayed the Democratic Party, and so they weren't paying enough attention to the fact that wages were stagnating. And as I say, it was a kind of a gradual thing. It didn't fall off a cliff. But they should have pushed harder to keep raising the minimum wage. They should have definitely pushed harder. And of course, I'm trying to rewrite history here. But on the Reagan period effort of continuing to cut the taxes at the top, so that the public policy contributed to this increasing disparity that we've had ever since then. If the tax code had been kept more fair, if there had been more of a response to keeping the incomes up of people at the bottom, it wouldn't have been so serious. But the basic fact is all of these low-wage jobs that replaced all of these better-paying jobs.
Let's get back just for a minute here to poverty and the historic trip that you took with Robert Kennedy to the South, to Mississippi in the 60s, where kids were dying from malnutrition and hunger, and it, you know, this tour really shocked people. It shocked the nation. Can you just tell us about that, what you saw, and how it affected your entire career?
I was working for Robert Kennedy already for maybe 2.5 years, a little less, in 1967, when we scheduled hearings to that were about reauthorizing the War on Poverty, the Economic Opportunity Act. And there was a Head Start program in Mississippi that was quite wonderful. Mully County, it was actually the largest employer in Mississippi, but it had gotten politically controversial because the political power structure in Mississippi saw it as a great threat. So the Senate subcommittee that Robert Kennedy was a member of went down there to bring some national attention to the good work of that Head Start program. And my wife, who I hadn't yet met, was the counsel
to them.
That's Marion
Wright Edelman.
Yes. And was the head of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund office down there. Came to testify about that, except that she was deeply concerned, appropriately so, obviously, about what had happened with this rising extreme hunger and malnutrition, which was a political fact. It wasn't because there was some kind of a famine. It was that the power structure wanted as much of the black community to move out of Mississippi as they could. There were economic changes on the plantations. The minimum wage had been applied to the plantations, and there were new chemicals and mechanical pickers and all that. They didn't need the labor anymore. So they pushed people off the plantations, and there were literally people in Mississippi who had no income, no income. So that's why we saw horribly children who had distended bellies, swollen stomachs, sores on their arms and legs that wouldn't heal. It was shocking. And from there came the political effort that continued after Robert Kennedy's death, that was picked up by Richard Nixon, that was carried on by George McGovern in the Senate, and got us the national food stamp program that we have that covers everybody in the country whose income is low enough to need it. There's terrible poverty in Mississippi still. There are 6 million people in this country now whose only income is food stamps. But they have that. You won't see children with swollen bellies in the United States, even as we're deeply concerned about the number of people in extreme poverty.
So you say that the poverty looks different in America today. Can you just kind of compare and contrast?
Yes. The simplest point about the changes in poverty in the United States are the children are the largest group who are poor. The elderly were, we remember that, but public policy made a huge difference. If there's any doubt about the relevance of public policy, you can just look at the elderly, although there are many other things to point to. So in the early 70s, we indexed Social Security to inflation. We enacted SSI, Supplemental Security Insurance, for the poor elderly. Of course, Medicaid and Medicare came into play. And now the elderly are less poor than the rest of the population, and children are the poorest group. Why are they the poorest group? Because their parents have these low-wage jobs. And to an important extent, the safety net for people not working has had a huge hole blown in it. But that's the major change. Now, there's another major change, which is extremely important, and that's the number of single moms that we have. And this, of course, is a matter of great debate. Why is that? Is it a racial issue? All of that. We need to understand that the number of single moms, of women who are having babies not being married, that's increased all over the world. It cuts across racial lines. I don't want to minimize the fact that the largest percentage of women who are having babies and not being married are African American. But still, it cuts across racial lines. And for our purposes in this conversation, really important to understand that what that does in a low-wage nation is that the person who has only one possibility, only one worker in the household to try to earn enough to support the family is very likely not to be able to succeed in doing that. So the poverty rate now for single moms with children under 18 is 47.9%. That's really a stunner.
And that means children.
And that means children.
We're talking with Peter Edelman. He's the author of So Rich, So Poor, Why It's So Hard to End Poverty in America. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. And we want to invite our listeners to join our conversation. We're at 866-798-8255. It's a toll-free number. Are you having trouble making ends meet? We'd like to hear what's happening with you and how you're making it. And are you working at a job that doesn't cover your expenses or doesn't provide health care? Give us a call at 866-798-8255. Again, that's a toll-free number. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. And if you're somebody who provides services to those in great need, like at shelters or hospitals or food banks, let us know what your experience is. Do you have ideas on how we reignite our commitment to a fairer society and for opportunity for all? 866-798-8255 is our toll-free number. That's 866-798-TALK. Again, you can also send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. And we'll get to those calls in just a minute. Go ahead and give us a call. So one of the things that I wanted to get to here is, you know, after 40 years of kind of going backwards on this, or the pendulum swinging what are you propose as to how we turn things around today? What are some of the solutions?
First of all, let's understand about the going backwards. We have public policies that work. I mentioned Social Security, SSI, and I mentioned food stamps. But there's a long list of things, including the Earned Income Tax Credit for low-income workers who have children, and some help with housing ought to be more. It's very important. But we should understand that the programs and policies that we have nationally, and they vary by state, and you have terrible trouble here in California, of course, are keeping 40 million people out of poverty. There would be 86 million people who were poor if we didn't have those programs. So when Ronald Reagan said we fought a war on poverty and poverty won, that's just not true. A lot of things he said aren't true. But anyway, that's one of them. The problem is that the economy is so structured, and what's happened, not just to poor people, but the entire bottom half, is really what the issue is. Now, what would we do? Well, number one, let's recognize the problem. Let's recognize the inequality. Let's look at the people at the top and whether they're paying a fair share, and I suggest that they're not. And then there are two levels. I mean, we also have to talk about educating our children. We have to talk about building strong communities and healthy neighborhoods. But on the income side, in terms of people who are working, and it's now 103 million people who have incomes below twice the poverty line. That's a third of our country that is one paycheck away from bankruptcy.
Do you want to explain for our callers what the poverty line is and what you mean when we're talking about these terms?
Yes, absolutely. It's not very realistic. It's now about $19,000 in 2012 for a family of three, about $23,000 for a family of four. Try to live on that. Maybe if you're on a farm in the South and growing your own food, you can make it. So just to keep that in mind. So when I say under twice the poverty line, I'm talking under $46,000 for a family of four. A third of the American people have incomes that leave them struggling to make ends meet. That's one of the problems. The other problem is at the very bottom. All of these people where we've especially mothers and children, again, the children, again, women, who where we blew a hole in the safety net when we radically reformed, not reformed, the then aid to dependent families with dependent children, in other words, welfare. So there's two sets of things. For people who are working and who are not making it, minimum wage, strengthening unions, the kinds of work supports that also add up to a money equivalent, health care, help with child care, help with housing, help sending our children to post-secondary education. And then because the wage is still not the median job in this country pays less than $34,000. Half the jobs pay less than that. That's how serious the problem is. A quarter less than the poverty line for a family of four. We have the earned income tax credit and the child tax credit, and those are very helpful, but they're not good enough. So over a period of time, we're going to have to we hope that the Chinese and people in India will raise their wages and help us in global competition, but we need to look at how do we raise family incomes.
And you mentioned India, and I'm wondering, is the U.S. different from other nations in terms of how we look at poverty? It seems like, and I don't know if this is American exceptionalism or not, but it seems like in this country, if you're poor, you've done something wrong, or there's that mentality.
There is. We have this American exceptionalism, as you said, the Horatio Alger story of making it on his own, although if you actually read it, he finds the rich man's dog and brings it back and gets rewarded, but never mind. So we have this sort of individualism pioneer spirit. Now, the distribution of income is so much flatter everywhere else except the UK and Israel, where it's about as much disparity as we have in the United States. And that's a big part of this. And the safety nets are much better at the bottom in all industrialized countries. And so we just need to keep working at doing better on all of that.
And let's go very quickly to Harry in San Francisco. Harry, you have a quick question, and we're just about to go to break. So go ahead. Welcome to your call. Harry, you're on your call? Do we have Harry? Harry, can you hear me? Hi, thanks. Welcome to your call. Go ahead. You had a quick question.
Yes, I wanted to know about your opposition to welfare to work and the effects and repercussions of that over the decades, because it seems like it's based upon disastrous suppositions.
So you're talking about the 1996 so-called welfare reform law, correct?
Right.
Okay, thank you, Harry. Let's get a quick response. You've got about 30 seconds, and then we'll go to a break, and you can talk more about it.
Yes, that's, of course, a longer answer. But the basic answer is that we took welfare from being – first of all, we needed to change welfare to help people to get to a job, and we didn't do that. Instead, we changed to a kick in the pants to tell them to get a job. But the basic point is that there was a legal right to welfare in the past, and there is not now. And in half the country, it's basically gone.
And that's why you have these 6 million people with no income except
that
food stamps.
Correct.
We're talking with Peter Edelman. He's the author of So Rich, So Poor, Why It's So Hard to End Poverty in America. And we want to invite you to join our conversation. How can we end this nearly 40-year cycle of decline in employment and increase in poverty? What are the conversations that we need to have? You can give us a call at 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. I'm Holly Kernan, and you're listening to Your Call. We'll be right back after this short break.
You're hearing Your Call on KALW San Francisco 91.7 FM. KALW's email newsletter is a great way to keep up to date with local public radio, as well as the latest developments in non-commercial media. We won't jam your inbox. Just every week or two, you'll get an email from us with updates on KALW programming and public events, as well as the occasional free ticket offer. It's easy to sign up. Just click on the e-newsletter link on our website, kalw.org.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. That's also where you can listen to past shows and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up next. Tomorrow, we're going to talk about the transgender community. We'll host a conversation about the trans movement for social and legal equality. 34 states can still deny employment, housing, or education to those who identify as transgender. And we're also offering a special tomorrow at 11 a.m. It'll be a special Your Call following the Supreme Court's ruling on the challenge to the health care reform bill. So what questions do you have about the court's decision, which is expected to come down tomorrow? What do you want to know about how it will affect your access to medical care and the future of the health care locally and nationally? Where does the movement for health care for all go next? You can join us for that special broadcast on Your Call on the Supreme Court's decision on the Affordable Care Act. That'll be tomorrow at 11 a.m. Friday, of course, is our media roundtable. That's the day we speak with journalists about the week's news coverage. And today we're having a conversation about the American dream and the growing ranks of poor and nearly poor in the United States. You can join our conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. You can also post comments at yourcallradio.org. We're speaking with Peter Edelman. He's the author of So Rich, So Poor, Why It's So Hard to End Poverty in America. And again, I want to invite our callers. I think we have one line open, and we're going to go to those lines in just a moment. If you work providing services to those in great need, like at a shelter or a hospital or a food bank, let us know what's happening in the streets. 866-798-8255. And if you have ideas on how we reignite our commitment to a fairer society, to opportunity for all, let us know. Are unions the answer? Do we need to look at this issue in a different way and try non-traditional solutions? Is government the solution? 866-798-8255. How do we spark activism? What should it look like? And how does Occupy fit into all of this? The number again is 866-798-8255. And again, our guest is Peter Edelman, author of So Rich, So Poor, Why It's So Hard to End Poverty in America. So I'm going to go to our calls in just a moment. But you say in your book that I thought the Great Recession might renew our commitment to ending poverty. And pretty much the opposite has really happened.
We've had two things that interact here. The bigger thing, of course, is that, surprising to many of us, the 2010 elections were a disaster for the country, but especially for low-income people and in a lot of other ways. And so the things that President Obama was able to ask and get from Congress came to a screeching halt. The answer to everything became no. Within that, I think it's also true, I didn't expect this, and maybe naively on my part, people who were newly poor, who I thought might become more sympathetic once they tasted poverty, had a sort of I'm all right, Jack, if people remember that movie, you know, pull up the gangplank kind of thing. I'll take the help, but those other people that have been poor all along, there must be something wrong with them. They're not like me, so I don't have any particular concern. And so that has been the unfortunate, I think, fact politically. Where we are on all of this, we need to separate, which is that we are going to get out of this recession at some point, although it's slower than all of us would like. But then what happens? And I'm worried about continuing to have all the low-wage jobs, and I'm also, we got to remember about that safety, that hole in the safety net that we blew for people at the bottom, that we're up to 20 million people with incomes below half the poverty line, that there are so many, especially children and their mothers, women and children, who have these incredibly low incomes, and we need to tackle that.
And you're saying that the safety net is so frayed that people are falling straight through.
Well, specifically, it's welfare. It's specifically cash assistance. There are other things that need to be improved, but the hole we blew is about cash assistance for mothers with children. The heart of an anti-poverty strategy is jobs, but we have to have a decent safety net.
Well, and we also ought to have a conversation about what we're calling welfare, because we certainly don't call the mortgage tax credit welfare, and yet that could certainly be considered a type of welfare. It just generally goes to the very middle
class.
There
are big corporations all over America.
Corporate welfare, yeah. So
yes, it's the terminology. I don't know what we should say, but it's cash assistance to mothers and children, and it is a safety net. And it's in the context, should always be in the context of the major thing we're doing is helping people get and keep jobs.
Well, let's hear from Rebecca in Oakland, and I want to let our audience know that... Oh, Rebecca, are you there? Hold on one second. I just want to let people know that we reached out to local community groups to find out how people are organizing around solutions to poverty. So let's hear from Ben. Hi, is this Ben Mangan from EARN? Ben, are you with us?
Hi. This is Ben. I'm here.
Hi, Ben. Thank you so much for joining us. Let us know what you do with EARN.
Sure. We're an organization based here in San Francisco that creates prosperity for low-income workers, very specifically by helping them to save and invest. And we have found a really remarkable level of success for people when they begin to save even very small amounts of money in a way that allows them to envision a different future for themselves and for your kids. And I was so struck, Professor Edelman, by the statistic you cited, nearly 50% of kids who are in households with parents under 18 who are living in poverty. And so I am a strong advocate for when you're dealing with people who are at the point when they can think beyond the day-to-day, helping people to save so that they can make investments in things like education and in starting small businesses and even in just having some emergency savings, which is an important form of insurance for low-income households. And we've had really remarkable success here in the Bay Area helping thousands of low-income families, people on average who are earning under $20,000 a year in their households, save over $5 million in the past 10 years. And our research has shown that these folks in many cases are totally transformed and have a very different view of the future as a result of finally being able to, one, have a little more control over their destinies, and savings plays an important role in that. And two, when they are able to accomplish something, even sometimes hitting a savings goal, which has felt impossible for them, they have far greater faith in their ability to achieve other goals that are even more important. And so my question actually for Peter Edelman is your view on some of the best ways to integrate a safety net approach, which we absolutely need. And for people who are not working and not at a point where they can even think about saving, we clearly need that. But how do you integrate that with some other approach that is directly tied to creating prosperity for people on the other side of moving people just beyond poverty?
And Ben, stay with us. Will you have another question for you?
Well, sure.
Well, thank you, Ben, and thank you for what you're doing. And, of course, you could tell us a lot more about how many counterparts you have around the country because what EARN is doing is duplicated, replicated. I was in Durham, North Carolina, the other day, and there are people there doing the same kind of thing. That's certainly one of the things. We need to invest in education and the development of the skills to work at the best job that somebody can do consistent with their abilities. So that's one of the answers. Especially getting people not only to finish high school, but to use in the 21st century, so much work that pays at least enough to live on depends on having some post-secondary education. And that's extremely important. So that's one of the pieces. I think all of this whole area of financial literacy and helping people to understand how to manage their finances, how to help them grow, very, very important. And the larger point, I think, about EARN and many other things is that the strategies that we need here, I'm talking big picture, broad brush, national policy to get incomes up, to support education and training, all of that. What people do at the local level, as you're doing, is just extremely important in a whole variety of ways. I think of Project Match in Chicago, where a woman named Toby Herr has been at this for years, and women who have grown up for whatever reason, didn't get education and training, desperately want to work, don't have the skills, but they need not only the training, but also a coach, some personal support to make that happen for themselves. So the local activity, the community activity is extremely important.
And we know that there's a lot going on here in the Bay Area around this, Ben and Earn being one of those groups that are doing great work. Ben, stay on the line with us here. I'd like both you and Peter to respond to an email. Here's a listener in Santa Cruz says, I've been unemployed for 6 months. I find myself losing confidence and hope. If I were homeless, I don't see how I would be able to even fake presentability. If we don't grant our fellow citizens a basic degree of dignity, how do we expect them to keep looking for work? So what kind of advice do you give to somebody who's literally losing hope?
Gosh, we have people struggling in that way all over the country now and kind of looking the other way. People end up whoever has written here having to move in with family or friends, and they end up moving from place to place. Terrible for their children. Washington, D.C., homelessness is up 74% since for families. I keep hope alive, but we need enough jobs. And right now, we have so many people in this country who are unemployed simply because jobs are not available.
Well, and it seems that, and I'm going to get to you, Ben, now, too, but it also seems that one of the things that you said in your book is that we need to break this silence. There's this shame around this, and there's this sense that it's invisible in some ways and that it's not a collective problem. Ben, did you want to speak to that email?
Yeah, just in response to the point you just made, Holly, there's a real dark side to the ethos of the American dream. You know, if you work hard and you persevere, you'll make it and you'll create great success. And the other side of that coin is that if you aren't making it, it's just your fault. And the fact is, there are huge forces at work in our public policies related to employment and wealth that are far greater than any individual's will. And so to Professor Edelman's point, we need to address this at a broad brush level with policies that create real opportunity for people and meet strivers halfway. With regard to the specific email from your listener, I would say, based on what we've learned here at EARN, that just setting your sights on a very simple goal that you can accomplish, something you do every day or every week that may not be the thing that will move you into a job, but will give you some sense of having accomplished something, is an important first step that allows you to build your confidence, to regain your dignity, and move towards something even greater.
Well, thank you so much for that, Ben. And we'll put a link to EARN. And the way that EARN works is that if you're a low-income saver, your savings will be usually matched once or twice. I think it's twice, so that every dollar that you save becomes $3 in the bank. Let's go next to Rebecca in Oakland. She is with the Women's Economic Agenda Project. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. Women's Economic Agenda Project, I am an organizer of the U.S. Courts of Women on Poverty. This is the result of a resolution of action from the U.S. Social Forum in 2010 in Detroit, in which different organizations, national from all over the country, decided to host these Courts of Women on Poverty to
sort of seeking testimony from women about poverty?
Excuse me?
So you were seeking testimony from women about living in poverty?
Correct.
Gotcha.
Correct. The World Court of Women is a big conference that has happened for the last 30 years all over the world. But coming to the U.S. and talking about poverty, the poverty has this quality of being so pervasive and at the same time so invisible. So we really wanted to give testimony and talk about it, how it is not isolated facts and it's not just because of people's faults, but it's a structural and very pervasive problem. We have many, many elite organizations here in the Western region. It happened in May, the conference. Mm-hmm. But what we're doing is talking about the resolutions of action that came from that very important
event. So can you give us a sketch of some of those resolutions of action? So these are solutions.
Yes. Well, the resolutions of action are about what we consider are the most pressing problems: homelessness, property rights, foreclosures, lack of jobs, immigration.
And so what do you propose to do about that? What are some of these resolutions, Rebecca?
Yeah, okay, that is a great question. Let me just finish the list because it's long. It has to do with immigration.
Actually, you know what, Rebecca? Just because we're running short on time, I'd rather to hear about some of the solutions, if you'd indulge me.
These resolutions, we don't believe that are going to change anything when we try to alleviate poverty. We believe that we really need to go for the change of policies, structural changes. And what we want to do is support different initiatives in the community that are actually doing something to make big change. And I really love this example from the Unity High School in Oakland, where high school students came together, did the research, and came up with a proposal to put in the ballot to create free education for all Californians, for example. That they needed 800,000 signatures. I don't think that they made it, but that these are real changes and not just a little basket of goodies, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And we are really trying to speak with the community. We are trying to educate ourselves as of the poor people being the transformative agents.
Right.
And not waiting for it to come from above, because definitely from above, we're just getting poverty.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that with us, Rebecca. And that's really heartening to hear about, you know, having it be people on the ground that are taking action and not waiting for this to be something that will be solved by government. Let's go to Robbie in Oakland. Hi, Robbie.
Hi, how are you doing this morning?
Fine. Thank you for joining us. Let us know about what you're doing with Causa Justa.
Yeah, so Causa Justa, we're a membership-based organization in Oakland and in San Francisco. We do work around housing rights and immigrant rights, and our main focus is really on both providing like rights-based services and doing direct action campaigns, but it's really about the development and the engagement of people who are, you know, low-income folks, Black and Latino communities, who are most impacted by the economy and who have been prior to this recession. So for us, we feel like a big way to solve, you know, the question of poverty is really about like organizing people and organizing folks who have, who, you know, are living day to day, really trying to meet their basic needs. And I really think that's where the conversation really, really should go to, is like, how can we provide ways for people to have their basic needs that doesn't rely so much on the kind of fluctuating market that has really, you know, left especially communities of color out of the economy for decades, for years.
Well, Robbie, stay with us, because that's a big piece of Peter's book. And Peter, I'm hoping you can just speak a little bit to what Robbie be saying.
Well, I think one of the things that I would add to the list that I think is just vital in terms of working with low-income people and organizing is for people to be involved politically. We need to do everything that's being done, so I'm kind of asking for a 25-hour day. I know that. About housing and about immigration rights and about all the things that were touched on. But certainly one of our issues is that people are not nationally, I don't mean specifically in this neighborhood of Oakland or somewhere in the Bay Area, both organizing to elect people who are going to be responsive to these issues and then to hold them accountable once they're elected. I worry that one of our problems is that we elected Barack Obama and we were all joyous, and then we went back to what we were doing and left it to him to cope with the problems instead of being there through getting the health care enacted and all the rest of the things that need to be done. So that's what I would want to add to the conversation.
Political activism.
Yes.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, and the way that we organize communities, I mean, you know, the work that we do is more about organizing communities and neighborhoods and folks to stay and remain in their homes. So really, we're about protecting people's housing. And so we definitely, you know, there's a definite impact, and there's definitely ways that we hold elected officials accountable to support us in this fight. But really, it's really about how is it that we are making the demands, not just on politicians, but making the demands on the government and on the state as well, to make sure that there is some way that our basic needs and our basic right to housing is being protected. I mean, for us, we've been doing a lot of work with people who are fighting foreclosure. Mm-hmm. We've been doing a lot of work really targeting the banks, making a lot of demands directly on the banks. I mean, you know, as we talk about, you know, poverty and the biggest transfer of wealth that's, you know, happened in decades, the biggest transfer of land and wealth. I mean, trillions of dollars of wealth from Black and Latino communities and other communities of color has been transferred into the private sector around this whole foreclosure crisis, with everyone's homes being taken. And so when you look at poverty and you compound that with where things are with housing, then you see that, you know, it's both a complex question to think about solutions, but it also, you know, leads us to the conclusion that relying on the market is not the best for people who are in poverty.
Well, thank you so much for that, Robbie, and we'll put a link to Causa Justa at our website, which is yourcallradio.org. We have a full bank of callers, and I want to get to as many as possible, but I want to let you know that you can also continue this conversation by posting comments at yourcallradio.org. We can continue to brainstorm as a community around what we do about this deep issue of poverty in the United States. Let's go to Lena in Berkeley. Hi, Lena. Welcome to your call.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm enjoying the conversation. I just wanted to make a point that I think that the arts can play a really important role in this. In particular, filmmaking and photography and storytelling that lets people sort of see the real face of poverty in this country.
Mm-hmm. Is there something in particular that you're doing?
I mean, in my own way, there are things that I do. But I think in a broader way, I think that, you know, a lot of people don't really have a sense of what it means.
Right.
Just for
We're
sure.
getting back to that invisibility.
Well, the human stories are so important.
Human stories, because that's what changes people's minds.
Yes.
Too. You know, I think most people innately have empathy. And I think that a problem is that people don't really realize how emotionally difficult it is for people to be poor and how sad it is for families. And so, you know, I think if more people really had a true sense of what's happening and what it looks like, that most people would want to do something to make it better.
Well, great. Let's go. Thank you so much for that, Lena. I think that's really important. Let's go to Andrea in Santa Cruz. Welcome to your call, Andrea.
Thanks. Anyway, yeah, I'm disabled. I'm 45 years old, and I use a walker, and I've been in Santa Cruz a little over 20 years. And, you know, I have an advocate, and we've been trying. He's been working around the clock trying to get help, and the city and the county just keep saying, well, there's no funding. I've been homeless since October of 2009, and I have some serious disabilities, which one causes chronic fatigue. And we've had a problem here in Santa Cruz with women that are homeless being severely beaten and raped. And, you know, my time's going to be up here in the Poly Loft. It's a 30-day program, and it's coming up on July 7th. And if anybody out there's willing to help with a donation, so maybe at least I can get a motel room to have a safe place to lay down, they could call 831-471-9767, and that's the number of my advocate, John Colby. And I'd really we'd really appreciate it because I really need the help really bad. So I appreciate the show.
Thanks,
very
Andrea.
Much.
And I'm just going to give out the feedback at yourcallradio.org if anybody has any leads or help for Andrea. Feedback at yourcallradio.org. We're running out of time here. Let me just quickly go to Matt in Monterey. Hi, Matt.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Another great show you guys are putting on today. That last call was tough to listen to. You know, and I'll be very brief. The optimum way to create jobs and stimulate the economy is through private industry. I'm a private business in myself. But when private industry isn't doing the job, just like back in the Great Depression, it's incumbent upon we the people in the form of the federal government to step in and create those jobs. You know, our infrastructure in this country is crumbling. We need to rebuild roads and bridges and schools and water systems. And there's plenty of people out there who can do the work. So I think what we need is another, you're not supposed to call it a stimulus program anymore, but that's exactly what we need.
But like the New Deal. Matt, just because we have literally 1 minute left before the end of the show, thank you for that. I'm going to toss it to Peter to just get some final thoughts on that idea of a New Deal-like jobs program that pays people directly to do public works.
It's what we should have done in 2009. I'm a big supporter of President Obama, but I think that was a big failing of the Recovery Act. And we
was it a failing?
Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky from Chicago has a great piece of legislation on that.
But did it fail because there wasn't the political will to do something like that?
Well, that particular thing was a decision. I don't want to be a downer on that, but that the Obama administration made in terms of how to put together the Recovery Act. They really should have done what Matt was talking
about.
Is
there any possibility of doing something like that now?
No.
Not possible.
No,
well,
Tea Party
people
is
are
a,
gonna have
it's
to,
a two-word answer, Tea Party.
People are going to have to organize for what they want, and I'm so sorry that we have to leave it there. We've been speaking with Peter Edelman, author of So Rich, So Poor, Why It's So Hard to End Poverty in America. He's a professor at Georgetown University Law Center, and he worked as a top advisor to Senator Robert Kennedy. We'll put a link to all of those resources at our new website, which is yourcallradio.org, and you can continue this conversation there. Send your ideas, you can share them at yourcallradio.org. Thanks for everybody who called. Sorry we couldn't get to them all. I'm Holly Kernan. This is Your Call, and here's what's coming up tomorrow. What are transgender people facing today? On the next Your Call, we're talking about the trans movement for social and legal equality. 34 states can still deny employment, housing, or education to those who identify as transgender. What are the realities for those who live under the trans label? Join us at 10 or leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. What role should the government play in protecting trans people? How far has society come in terms of accepting gender variance? It's Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our daily podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Eric Jansen is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.